Hello and welcome to our L'Étape UK series by Le Tour de France podcast. Today, Sam Keir from Organisers Human Race will be talking to Ned Bolting. And this is all in advance of ICAP, L'Étape London by Le Tour de France, which takes place this September, starting and finishing at the Lee Valley Velo Park. It's a spectacular ride. If you'd like to join us, head to letaplondon.co.uk. That's letaplondon.co.uk. But for now, over to Sam and Ned.
Ned, hi, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. A little bit damp, but that's the way it is in northern France.
So you're in northern France, all set, ready for the start, the Grand Départ?
Off we go again. Yeah, exactly. it's an amazing event. You kind of forget about the size and the scale of it until you arrive at the Grand Départ once again. Kind of lost track of how many I've done there, but I think it's 14. But they all have their own characteristics and atmosphere, and you know, the different set of characters that make up the story of, you know, the narrative of the next 3 weeks to come. Who knows what's going to happen? That's the beauty of it.
So are you in Mont Saint-Michel?
I'm not actually. I'm sort of close to Utah Beach, but it's quite strange this time around, because the first couple of stages crisscross the Département de la Manche, heading north from Mont Saint-Michel, and the teams are all scattered over the peninsula, and all the press is staying everywhere else, so people are kind of crisscrossing in all sorts of different directions. But basically, the Tour de France has taken over the whole département. You can't get a hotel room here for love nor money anywhere near the race.
Fantastic. So you must be grateful that you're not dashing around looking to speak to riders. This year you're up in the commentary box, your debut as a tour commentator. How are you feeling about your move from the pandemonium of the finish line scrum to the more rarefied atmosphere of the box?
Well, I'm going to miss the pandemonium, I have to say, because it's part of the character of the tour. What makes it's why it stands apart from other events like, you know, with respect, Wimbledon, or you know, anything involving football these days, which is so sanitised. One of the great things about cycling, even at the highest level, maybe especially at the highest level, is the chaos that surrounds it. And the Tour de France and chaos go hand in hand. And I will miss that slightly, but I'm looking forward to, you know, stepping into the commentary box with David Miller for the first time on the Tour de France. Enormously, it'll be a huge challenge, but it's a huge honour as well.
You mentioned David. You've obviously commentated together on races like the Dauphiné, and you're fast gaining a reputation amongst UK cycling fans as a formidable double act. What's it like to work with David on the mic?
Well, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, really, in terms of what David offers to the viewing public, because his insights are so fresh. You know, it's not that long ago since he was part of the peloton, and you know, one thing that you know about David Miller, I know he divides opinion, we can talk about that as well, but one thing that even his detractors would, I think, admit is that he is articulate and intelligent and aware. And what he's doing in commentary, I think, is bringing an extraordinarily fresh amount of insight to the race in a manner which I don't really think has been done before. It's almost when he gets on, when really gets engaged in a subject and gets on one, so to speak, when he's watching a race, it's almost like you're watching it for the first time, but you've never seen a bike race before. But seeing it through his eyes, as he's allowing us to do, I think just opens doors to us all in terms of our perception of what is actually going on. You know, because unless you've been there, like he has done, I think it's unimaginable the amount of nuance and detail and tactical shenanigans that are going on, and he brings that to life.
Absolutely, and you're lucky enough this year that you've got lots of new toys to play with from the data side of things, with telemetry and stuff like that. Do you think that's a natural partner to David's insight and your insight into the overall viewing product?
Yeah, I'm not such a numbers kind of guy, really, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think that there's always been a clamour for more information and telemetry, as you say, and people always sort of hold up Formula One as a great benchmark of what you can do in terms of offering the viewer, in inverted commas, an enhanced experience. But I think that once we've kind of absorbed these numbers once or twice, we'll tire of them and get bored by them very quickly. Because after all, how many times can you see that someone's heart rate is doing 167? And what does that really tell us? and that someone's cadence is this. You know, I think the beauty of bike racing is in the tactics and the psychological aspect of the game, and the random elements and what's the weather doing, and you know, and all that has much more of a bearing for me on the interest of the race than raw data, so to speak. So I can understand that why certain people are excited by these developments. It doesn't massively float my boat, I have to say.
Now, I suppose that's where we're having someone like you say with David's insight is where the real value comes in. That for the rest of us who are never going to get to experience that, he's been there, he's done it, and so a number can say one thing, but the reality could be very different.
I think so. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. So moving on to the race itself, as we mentioned, and where you are now, the tour gets underway in Normandy, short hop across the Channel. At the risk of asking a stupid question, are we expecting lots of Brits to make the trip?
Well, do you know what? I've just turned off the motorway, and for the first time in whatever it is, 14 years of covering the tour, I've seen a motorway sign written in English, put up by the organisation, and it said, and I quote, TDF parking next exit.
Brilliant.
It didn't say prochaine sortie, it said next exit. I think that tells you all you need to know about the clientele they're expecting for the next couple of days.
Absolutely. So contrary to sort of the wider political scene, plenty of Brits rushing into Europe this weekend.
I think they're rushing out of the UK.
Yeah.
I certainly was. I mean, life is so strange back at home at the moment, isn't it, that I couldn't wait to get out, frankly, and I arrived on Tuesday morning into Roscoff in my car, which I dumped in a campsite full of all the camping equipment I'm going to use when I finally get on holiday after the end of this race. And then I unpacked my bike and I cycled from Roscoff over to Mont Saint-Michel over a couple of days, just on my own, just clearing my head of everything that I'd left behind and everything that was to come. And do you know what? France is still here. The French countryside is still a wonderful, welcoming place, and so are the French people. And everything is all right in the world, I promise you.
Absolutely. In amongst all the uncertainty, le tour, c'est le tour.
Exactly, yeah. C'est le tour.
So talking of Brits, stage one on Saturday, a sprinter stage to Utah Beach. Can Mark Cavendish finally secure a yellow jersey?
Well, I think it would be a major upset if he does.
Yeah, so
for the simple reason that he has never beaten Marcel Kittel in a sprint.
And is Kittel...
I think it's a remarkable statistic.
Absolutely. And is Kittel at his best, do we think?
Well, no. Well, this is it, actually. This is the interesting point, that, you know, it is possible that Cavendish might just beat Marcel Kittel, but that doesn't mean that he'd necessarily win the race, because I think probably right now André Greipel has got the measure of both of them.
Absolutely. We've got Greipel beating Kittel at the German national champ, so he's probably feeling pretty confident.
Yeah. Although, having said that, the last time I saw them, apart from that, I mean, I didn't actually see the German national championships, but I was working on the Giro d'Italia, and the two stages that Marcel Kittel won, Greipel was nowhere.
Mm.
And Kittel looked absolutely bestial in terms of his strength. So I would still make Marcel Kittel a strong favourite, actually. But, you know, right now the wind is blowing strongly. I think the weather forecast suggests it'll carry on blowing. It's wet. So there's going to be a tremendous battle even to get to the final kilometre. And God knows what might happen en route to the stage finish in Utah Beach.
Absolutely. I was going to say, sort of on paper, when you look at the profile, it looks like a nailed-on sprint, but winds are...
Not if the weather does this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Team Sky are already saying that they will seize every... Well, this is their intention, that they will seize every opportunity to damage and hurt their rivals. And Dave Brailsford has just done a press conference and he pointed at Luke Rowe, Ian Stannard, Geraint Thomas and Vasyl Kiryienka. And he said, look at these four. If you can't do something in the crosswinds with these four riders, then you shouldn't be in the business. You know, so yeah. We've got that wonderful prospect, haven't we, of if the weather does play ball with us, that we have on stage one a race within a race, or rather two races contained within one. You know, a race amongst the general classification contenders, not to lose the Tour de France, as Vincenzo Nibali did. But, you know... and the yellow jersey up for grabs as well.
Talking of wind, I think we're hearing a bit of it down the phone, but still, that creates a bit of sets the scene for Saturday, perhaps.
It's pure atmosphere what you're getting from.
Exactly. It's like being there, Ned.
Yeah.
In terms of the GC battle, of course, all British eyes on Chris Froome. The question everyone's asking, can he become the eighth, or will he become the eighth man to win three Tour de France?
Yes, of course he can. I'm trying to think whether he will. And it's a stronger team that Sky have brought to the race than I've ever seen. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, if you look at Mikel Nieve, Sergio Henao, and the addition of Mikel Landa, as well as Wout Poels, who's won a monument this year. I mean, what a team of climbing talent that is to look after Chris Froome. So he's got everything in his favour. He's come to his best form in the season at just the right moment with a dominant display in the Dauphiné. So, yes, of course he can. The question is, what can the little Colombian do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come on to Quintana and the rest of the GC beasts in a minute. But if Froome were to take the Maillot Jaune again this year, yeah, he'd be the first rider to win back-to-back tours since Big Mig 21 years ago. Ignoring the.
I lost the last part of that question, but I think you're asking me about his place in history and how. And he's the first person since Miguel Indurain, if you take out the Armstrong years. Was that the gist of it?
That's spot on, Ned. Yeah. Why do you think it's been so hard for a clean rider to string back-to-back victories together?
Why has it been so hard? I think that your question implies the answer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think that the doping years were a way of erasing frailty. They were a way of levelling out questionable form. And that was part of the problem with the distortion that they offered up. You know, I mean, you can even, you know, listen, by the way, I'm not saying to you that Chris Froome is clean, because only one man knows the answer to that. All I'm saying is that there is no evidence of Chris Froome doping, right?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And they are two slightly different things.
Certainly.
But what we have seen from Chris Froome in both of his, especially last year when he won, is a slow and gradual weakening throughout the 3 weeks. He makes his statement very early on and then hangs on a bit.
Yeah.
Now he's determined to put that right this year and ride slightly differently through the 3 weeks. But I think that is suggestive of a clean race.
No, certainly. So talk us through Froome's main rivals for the GC. You've mentioned the little Colombian. What are the various contenders' strengths and weaknesses, and where in the race can they look to target Froome?
Start in reverse order, if you like, and look at the periphery and some of the riders who you consider slightly more outs. And I'm going to put straight away into that category Fabio Aru, who really should be amongst the favourites for this race, but has demonstrated absolutely nothing this year, and quite the opposite of nothing, actually. I thought his performance in the Dauphiné was almost embarrassing. And was only saved by a stage win on a stage where a GC contender really shouldn't have been looking to win. So that was a very mixed message there. And of course, he's got Vincenzo Nibali kind of lurking in the wings of that team. I don't see Nibali beating Chris Froome, but you never know with Nibali, because as he demonstrated on the Giro, he can remain in contention and seize his opportunity ruthlessly as and when he needs to. However, the calibre of opposition on the Tour de France is of a different nature altogether than the riders he beat in the Giro. So, those two Astana riders, not sure about them really. And the same kind of applies to a certain extent to Richie Porte and TJ Van Garderen, who are another, you know, two-pronged team with BMC. I'm not sure who is the stronger, and I don't think we'll find out until we get into the mountains. They're quite evenly matched, I think, and Richie Porte doesn't really seem to have shown too many signs just yet of having stepped up significantly on where he was with Team Sky, but there's a lot of racing still to come. Van Garderen does look stronger. He's had a better season in preparation for this year, but you know, even a good Van Garderen is still, I think, some way off the top two steps of the podium. It might be good enough to get him into third place, or maybe even better, but I still think it's unlikely. Then you look at the French Challenge. Bardet and Pinot being the two best of them. Pinot is more consistent. He's the stronger rider every day. He's a more defensive rider. And he's kind of reinvented himself. He's just won the French National Time Trial Championships, which is almost unimaginable for Thibaut Pinot to have achieved. And his team have concentrated on time trialing. Now, there isn't a team time trial on this year's event, but it is suggestive of a much more professional considered approach by FDJ, and they've reaped benefits from it all throughout the year, and Pinot is stronger than ever. So he's probably the most realistic prospect for the French of a podium place or better. However, Bardet is a rider who can do great deal of damage on one stage. Should he identify one stage, he can propel himself back into GC contention if he slips out of it by taking a huge chunk of time. He's explosive and he's brave and he's a real racer in that regard. So he's dangerous, but I think probably Pinot is the more credible opponent from the French challenge. Which leaves, I think, probably Contador, who is 85% of the Contador that won the Giro d'Italia last year, I think. And that 85% is not good enough to beat Chris Froome in my eyes. And I think Froome has a psychological hold over him now as well on the Tour de France. Which leaves one. And that one is extremely dangerous because you must be sure of one thing. And that is that Nairo Quintana will win the Tour de France. At some point soon, Nairo Quintana will win the Tour de France. There's no doubt about that. And it might be this year. And I say that because this is a pure climbers Tour de France. The two time trials are suited for climbers, not time trialists. So Cancellara and Martin might as well just forget that. And Quintana won't lose any time or significant time to Chris Froome there. And Quintana can do it on one day, on one stage. If he decides to go and identifies one particular summit finish, he can just do it. And he can take 5 minutes. And those 5 minutes might be enough to haul back a two-minute deficit and put 3 minutes into his opponent. He's that good. And I think that's probably what will worry Chris Froome. Day after day, he'll be thinking, when does Quintana go? He left it too late last year. He won't make that mistake again this time.
So if we're looking at it as potentially or probably a two-horse race between Froome and Quintana, all things being equal, which of those two does the course suit most?
Both.
Fair enough. We don't think there's been a lot of talk about the lack of summit finishes until later on in the race and sort of quite a lot of descending to the finish. In previous editions, Froome has obviously got his advantage on the first summit finish and kept it. Does the change of style of the race make a difference in terms of Froome's chances?
Well, this is why Chris Froome needs to concentrate on so heavily on the third week of the race. Mm. When he said that publicly, he said that he can't do it. He can't do it in the same way that he won it last couple of occasions because there is so much climbing in that third week. And you can be sure that Quintana will just want to hold himself in contention up until that point and make sure that if he's down, he's not too far down. But Team Sky, to a certain extent, because of their favourite status, they won't be allowed a day off, ever. Yeah. They have to try and take time on Quintana, specifically Quintana, on every single occasion. Whereas Quintana has the luxury, in inverted commas, if that is a luxury, of kind of just defending his position and riding conservatively for the opening 2 weeks of the tour. So psychologically, Team Sky have to be on the front foot, which might just suit them, but it puts Chris Froome in a strangely exposed, wearing position every day, day after day. He's got to drop the Little Colombian, he's got to put major time into it. And if Quintana could just sit tight and ride clever, and be patient, and use his experience and his team, then it's all to play for going into the final salvo of stages, 17, 18, 19, 20.
Absolutely. And so when we talk about the must-see stages, of course we'll all be tuning into the nightly highlights show on ITV, but which of the stages we should be phoning in sick for work or cancelling weekend plans to sit through live in their entirety?
How about Saturday, stage one?
And two through to 21?
Well, listen, there are going to be flat patches, and there are in any tour. That you know, it can't all be fantastic racing all the way around. But the beauty of the way that Christian Prudhomme designs a course, I think, is that there are very few. You know, I think back to my earliest tours designed by the wonderful Jean-Marie Leblanc, but the opening 10 days were pretty tepid stuff compared to the way that races look now, you know. The Giro d'Italia as well was a great example of that this year. I thought it just held our fascination the whole way through. We barely had a dud stage. But if you're going to book time off, I think it's the whole of the third week, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you're right. That's where the phony war will end, and we'll see who's really got what it takes.
Yeah, and you can go back to work on stage 21, because that will be the same ludicrous procession that it always is.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, so just briefly moving back to some of the riders taking part. Obviously, we've mentioned Mark Cavendish and Froome and his teammates. But away from the Team Sky spotlight and focus on Mark Cavendish, what can we expect from the other three Brits in the race?
Young Dan McLean is the first name or the last name that springs to mind, whichever way you want to consider it. He's a rider I don't know a great deal about, so I'm looking forward to meeting him. I know as much as you guys do, probably, in that he's an exciting prospect, and the race that he won in, what was it, the Grand Prix de Dinan, I think, which was that extraordinary sprint that it almost became viral on the internet, that helicopter shot of him weaving his way up through the pack in the sprint finish and just exhibiting blistering pace, admittedly to beat a fairly second string field. But if he can replicate that on the Tour de France, however he did it, then it'd be fascinating to see how he does in the bunch sprints. Who are the other Brits? We've got Adam Yates.
Adam Yates.
Slow to medium progress from him year after year. I think that it's still a couple of years before you see him being a credible major GC rider. I would imagine that he'll lose a bit of time eventually and might start looking for an individual stage win. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong. He might be closer to the podium than I imagine, but I think that's a couple of years away, that. But Steve Cummings will do what Steve Cummings does. He will just identify one or two days, and he will leave his conventional berth at the back of the peloton. And as soon as you don't see him at the back of the peloton, be very, very frightened, because Steve Cummings will get himself in an attack and try and win a stage. That's what he does. It's almost like he doesn't ride for a team, Steve Cummings. He just rides for Steve Cummings. It's a wonderful thing to watch, this late blossoming of his career.
I can see us all on tenterhooks for the last 40k of a stage as Steve Cummings desperately tries to hang on to a lead, but it'll make for great viewing, I'm sure.
It'll happen as well. Yeah. That's the other certainty. That will happen. Whether or not he wins is a different question, but you will see Steve Cummings trying to hang on to a sole lead at some point in the tour. The other rider, I know he's not British, but deserves a mention, because he might have a great, great tour this year, and he might for the first time be a real GC name, and that's Dan Martin. Mm. Just watch out for him, because he is making a transformation now between someone who just looks for stages and, you know, is more suited to shorter, sharper climbs into a proper Grand Tour GC climber. I don't know how far down that transformation he is just yet, but he's on his way.
Certainly. So then finally, talking about your experience on the tour once again, and how it transformed you into a keen cyclist yourself. You've been very upfront about the fact that when you first covered the race, you knew very little about cycling, but like so many of us, you've been captivated by the magic of the tour. What is it about the race that so successfully turns us into full-blown cycling tragics?
I think it's because it rewards you so greatly, in the same way that, you know, solving a crossword puzzle is one of the most satisfying things you can do, or cracking a code. You know, it's such an impenetrable sport with its foreign languages and its dubious scoring system and its dubious participants, let's be honest, as well, with the kind of the moral matrix of doping as well to get your heads around. But But once you've kind of got immersed in it, and it's starting, the pennies start to drop, and everything starts to fall into place, and you suddenly understand why that team is working on the front, and why they're not in the breakaway on that particular day, and why that rider has dropped out of the breakaway to go back to the peloton, and you start the little pieces come together, and all of a sudden there's a whole universe of colour and variety that has just exploded on your screen in real time and into your life. And once you've kind of got a taste for that, I don't think there's any other sport that comes close. And what is deeply fascinating as well is that television does its best to bring all this to life, but even we would have to acknowledge that, you know, we can only show you 10% of the race. 90%, like an iceberg, remains hidden.
Absolutely. It's, you're almost looking for that through the looking glass moment where you finally feel that this strange world that you find yourself in makes a bit more sense. And I think that is the magic. And of course, you're a keen cyclist yourself now. And how big a role did the tour play in getting you onto your bike beyond the obvious exposure to the race?
Oh, everything. It meant that I got a bike, you know. I rediscovered my kind of, you know, our shared childhoods. We all had bikes when we were kids. We all rode when we were 10. And then at some point in our adult lives, most of us just put the bike away or lose our bikes, and we never get back on. And it took something as seismic in my life as covering the Tour de France for me to figure out, maybe I should just go and get a bike. And now riding a bike, several bikes actually, a shameful amount of different bikes that I've got in the cellar, is part of my everyday life. And I've even ridden to the Tour de France this year, which is a bit of a first for me. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
It certainly has an impact on us all, the Tour. You're an ambassador for the ICAP L'Étape London by Le Tour de France, one of the official UK sportives of the Tour. Why are sportives so important to the growth of cycling here in Britain?
Well, they give us all a little taste of a couple of things, really. One is, what's it like to ride on closed roads or in a controlled sort of, you know, piece of road and ride in a bunch? You know, we've seen it on the telly, but actually to get a taste for being surrounded by riders all moving at speed alongside you and with you, and what it feels like to draft and have riders on your wheel and moving a pack is, you don't get that anywhere else, really. So that's a great experience for people. And also, I think, you know, because the cycling community is quite bonded and quite well educated and quite well, well versed in the culture of cycling, I think it's an opportunity for like-minded people to get together. And most sporties are run, like this one is, over several hours. And just immerse yourself in what it is that you love doing and share conversations, experience, opinions, and have fun and celebrate this growing community of people who've become devotees of this sport. And, sportives, especially this one, because, you know, from a British perspective, using the touchstone of the velodrome in Lee Valley Park, that is a place of almost spiritual importance for British cycling, I think, because the 2012 London Olympics, the year of 2012, that summer of 2012, when just before the flood of Olympic gold medals in that velodrome, we were treated to the sight of the world champion, who happened to be British, being led out on the Champs-Élysées by the yellow jersey, who happened to be British. We're never going to get it that good again.
Absolutely.
We could be a cycling nation for the next 100 years and never get close to that summer again. So it means an awful lot, that place.
No, absolutely, some very fond memories. And as you say, both the Olympic legacy, as well, of course, the Grand Départ in 2014, stage three there, of the course of which...
Correct.
ICAP L'Étape London takes in much of... very happy memories, and I imagine many more to come for you over the next 3 weeks and in future years. So we wish you all the best over the next 3 years. Good luck in the box with David.
Thank you very much, and believe me, it is a box.
I can imagine. So are you at the finish or?
Always at the finish.
Yeah, absolutely. So the transfers aren't too nasty, I guess.
No, they're just sort of 9 out of 10 on the scale of 9, as opposed to the full 10 out of 10.
Heading in the right direction. Well, Ned,
heading in the right direction.
Thank you very much indeed for your time, and have a great 3 weeks.
Pleasure.
So thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with a new Le Tap UK series by Le Tour de France podcast. In the meantime, if you want to join us for ICAP Le Tap London by Le Tour de France, you should head to letaplondon.co.uk. That's letaplondon.co.uk, and you'll be able to register for a place in one of three distances. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.